today, the televised hearings in Donald Trump's impeachment process begin. And are Joe Swinson's Liberal Democrats cutting through to voters?
The big show begins on Wednesday.
For weeks, we've had to make do with reading through witness testimony in transcripts. But today, the impeachment of Donald Trump hits primetime.
It's a huge television event. It really is like the TV series of the book.
To the historic showdown this week on Capitol Hill, the impeachment inquiry into President Trump and his Ukraine call going public.
Many people have heard what all this is about, but it makes a big difference seeing the people involved say what happened in their own words and on TV. The impact is going to be tenfold.
As we head towards an election year, the coming weeks are set to be dominated by a political courtroom drama. At the heart of it, the contents of a 30-minute conversation between Donald Trump and the president of Ukraine that now threatens his presidency.
It's only the third impeachment in US history and the first in really the era of 24-hour news.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, impeaching Donald Trump. Julian, it's a momentous day in the impeachment process against Donald Trump because it's the first time that we'll get to see evidence being given. What's at stake for the president?
Trump's presidency is at stake. He is at a critical moment.
Julian Borgia is The Guardian's World Affairs editor and is based in Washington, D.C.
It's almost certain that impeachment will go through in that there is a Democratic majority in the House and that the evidence that he used his office to try and get political advantage by trying to get a foreign government involved in U.S. politics is now overwhelming. Impeachment really means you've been charged. It's like being charged in a criminal case. And so once you are impeached by the House of Representatives, it goes on to the Senate, and the Senate acts as a jury. So when it goes to the Senate, it's really your trial. And then the jury, the Senate, has to vote by two-thirds if you are to be convicted and then removed from office. Now, that is unlikely because the Republicans have a majority, and so far, the Republicans have stuck with Trump.
What has happened prior to these public hearings beginning?
What has been happening in the run-up is a whole succession of closed-door hearings where the House investigators have questioned several serving State Department and National Security Council officials and former officials and diplomats.
Tonight, for the first time, two key witnesses in the impeachment inquiry told lawmakers. What they told lawmakers, we now have the transcripts of.
Asking them about the transactions between Trump and Trump's circle and the Ukrainian government.
Between them, Michael McKinley, his former senior advisor.
They're calling on many of the same people who've already given evidence, Julian, but the difference is this is now being televised. Why?
Well, the Democrats are keen to bring this out into the open so that they can solidify public opinion.
That this is a critical moment and America's identity is very much at stake.
Up to now, the very long transcripts have been published and reported on by the media. But you have to remember, in such a polarized atmosphere, anything the media says can be dismissed as a fake. I think it will be quite powerful in terms of the Democrats getting their case across.
They're having people, I never even heard of some of these people. I don't know who they are. And by the way, it's all third-hand knowledge.
Republicans have been casting aspersions on each witness that comes out. They have been trying to denigrate them, play down their importance. So it's going to be important for the public to see who these people are who are speaking out in the flesh.
Let's go back. Can you remind us of the case that is against Donald Trump? What's he been accused of?
Well, this all started with a phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine.
New developments now in a story with many twists and turns, and it started with a whistleblower's complaint about President Trump's contact with a foreign leader.
On 25th of July, in that phone call, when Zelensky raises the question of military aid, Trump says, yes, but I want you to do us a favor, though. And a U.S. intelligence official who was serving in the White House got to hear about this call and so filed a whistleblower complaint. And it was that whistleblower complaint and then the efforts of the administration to suppress that complaint that really was the spark that began this whole impeachment process.
The president tweeted that it was fake news and denied he would say anything inappropriate on such a call.
And since then, we've heard from a succession of witnesses corroborating what was in the whistleblower complaint and also filling in a lot of detail about the sort of negotiations that were going on by Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, with the Ukrainians before and after that phone call.
And the Democrats felt there was enough evidence to impeach the president for this.
The actions taken to date by the president have seriously violated the Constitution, especially when the president says, Article 2 says I can do whatever I want.
Why was that?
The Democratic House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, had been reluctant to bring impeachment case against Trump on a number of other grounds, on the question of how close he was with Russia and questions of corruption and abuse of office in other ways. But it was very hard for her to avoid bringing an impeachment hearing after what seemed to be a very clear-cut case of abuse of office and the pressure from her own party to begin impeachment hearings was overwhelming. It also, at the same time, became clear that articles of impeachment would get a majority vote in the House. So that was what really flipped the decision for the Democratic leadership.
And if you read or watch or listen to any coverage of this impeachment process at the moment, Julian, the phrase that you hear time and time again is quid pro quo.
Number one, it's hard to say. Number two, it's a Latin phrase. Yeah. Is that what Democrats think the winning slogan of these hearings should be?
What does this mean in this context and why has it become so significant?
Well, quid pro quo is Latin for something, and that's really at the core of this impeachment process. President Trump was asking something of the Ukrainians, and that was to investigate his political opponents, in particular former Vice President Joe Biden. In return, he was offering something, and what he was offering was the power of his office and all that entailed in terms of giving military aid and allowing President Zelensky to come to the White House and get political kudos to his own political advantage. And that is where he is alleged to have violated the Constitution.
And what was Trump's defense when the story first broke? And how has he changed his position in the last few weeks?
Well, there have been various defenses that Trump has brought out. The first one is his ultimate denial. It was a perfect call.
It was beautiful. It was just a perfect conversation. I think
another defense is there was no quo to this quid pro quo.
I didn't do it. There was no quid pro quo.
And that the Ukrainians didn't know that military aid was being withheld. But that, as various witnesses have come forward, has also melted away, and it's become absolutely clear the Ukrainians were not only aware that military aid was being withheld, but were very anxious about it because they're fighting a war with Russia in the east of their country. Another defense that they've tried and since withdrawn is you might call the Mick Mulvaney defense. And that is the chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, went out and said, yes, of course this happened, but it's no big deal. It happens all the time. Get over it.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. Get over it.
Since then, the White House hasn't tried that one. But ultimately, that may be what they have to fall back on, saying, well, they didn't actually act on it. and eventually the military aid was released. So what's the problem here? That's really accepting and acknowledging that Trump tried a quid pro quo, but it just failed. And I should remember the Senator Lindsey Graham defense, which is this administration is far too disorganized and incoherent to have managed something like that, which has been a fallback on a number of issues, that there's no way that Trump is smart enough to have carried that off.
What I can tell you about the Trump policy toward the Ukraine, it was incoherent. It depends on who you talk to. They seem to be incapable of forming a quid pro quo. So, no, I find the whole process to be a sham, and I'm not going to legitimize it.
Julian, take us into the room where the hearings are going to begin today. A series of diplomats are going to give evidence over hours of questioning by a panel of Democrats and Republicans in a committee room in the Longworth House office building. What will it be like, and who is leading these hearings for the Democrats?
It is going to be packed. It's going to be extremely tense. I think there will be a sort of crackling sense of history in the making. And the Democrats in particular are going to want to make it a very somber occasion. And Adam Schiff, who is the chair of the House Intelligence Committee and who will really be in charge of proceedings, is very accomplished at that.
We're not fooling around here, though. We don't want this to drag on months and months and months, which appears to be the administration's strategy.
Up against him will be the Republicans who will be running interference for the president and will be seeking to go off on tangents and seeking to focus on Joe Biden and his son and seeking to bring the whole process into question. So it'll be a political battle as well as being, in a way, a legal battle.
And where will Trump be for all of this?
Trump himself won't be there today. He will be in the White House, we presume, trying to watch as much of it on television as possible. He's a bit of a TV addict anyway, and this is a critical day for him. But he has some official duties to perform. He has a visit from the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and there are pressing issues in that relationship, especially Syria. So one imagines that he today is going to project as far as he can that he's getting on with business, the affairs of state, while the Democrats are trying to distract the attention of the American public over small matters.
And Trump isn't a big fan of Adam Schiff, is he?
No, he calls him Shifty Schiff.
This is a fraudulent crime on the American people. But we'll work together with Shifty Shift and Pelosi and all of them.
He is really one of his bete noires because he has proven himself to be quite effective in eliciting damaging evidence.
Where he made up my conversation. He actually made it up. It should be criminal. It should be treasonous.
So he has emerged as one of Trump's main nemesis.
And who is leading the defense for the Republicans at these hearings?
Devin Nunes is really in charge of the defense team. He is an absolute Trump loyalist.
We don't even really know if this is a live person or not, this whistleblower. So there's a lot of questions, which is why we're going to have to interview this whistleblower before we get to these public hearings.
And really you can expect to see him launching the counterattack when it comes to cross-examination of some of these witnesses. And of course, the Republicans have their own witnesses. And we've seen from their witness list that where they want to go is concentrate on Hunter Biden and make it about what Joe Biden was doing when he was vice president and when Hunter Biden was working for this Ukrainian energy company.
But today, House Republicans named Joe Biden's son, the unidentified whistleblower, and others to its own request for public testimony.
They're going to try and make it about that and not about what Trump did.
This is going to be a TV show watched by millions. Who are the key characters providing testimonies that we should look out for?
Well, one of the most powerful witnesses will be the first one up. That would be Bill Taylor.
Bill Taylor. I mean, he was the ambassador. He's been ambassador under Bush and Obama, and he's worked for how many presidents?
Every president since Reagan.
Since 1985.
So I'm taking, if he said that's what happened, I'm going with him.
Who is this veteran diplomat who was persuaded to come back from semi-retirement and go and become ambassador to the Ukraine in May of this year, and who was witness to the effort to put pressure on the Ukrainian government to conduct these investigations, and who was outraged at the time and made a point of complaining.
Explosive testimony from Trump's top diplomat in Ukraine, Bill Taylor, behind closed doors for 10 hours. And if you read just his 15-page prepared opening statement, you know that Trump offered a quid pro quo.
So his testimony is likely to be very powerful. And then at the end of the week, on Friday, you're going to see Masha Yovanovitch.
Defying the Trump administration, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch went before lawmakers today after the State Department tried to block her testimony.
Very well-respected ambassador who found herself being smeared by Trump's own lawyer and being forced out of office by the Trump administration because she wouldn't go along with something that she saw was wrong. And she is, I think, going to be maybe one of the most passionate witnesses we're going to see, because she has voiced outrage at what has happened to U.S. diplomacy, what has happened to the U.S. State Department under the Trump administration.
And will we hear from the whistleblower at all?
The Democrats say they are not going to call the whistleblower. I mean, part of the whistleblower laws in the U.S. are that their identity should be protected. The position of the Democrats is that his complaint has been corroborated so many times by so many people, his public testimony is not necessary for them to make the case.
A key figure who emerged from the private hearings is the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland.
Hi, I'm Gordon Sondland, the new ambassador to the European Union.
Who's he, and why did he make the news recently?
He is a hotelier, a wealthy, successful hotelier, who backed a number of Republican presidential candidates before, at the last minute, backing Trump and giving $1 million to Trump's inaugural party, and then was given the job of being an ambassador to the European Union.
President Trump has asked us to accomplish a great deal in the coming years.
In the normal run of things, the ambassador of the European Union has nothing to do with Ukraine. It's not in the European Union. But he was assigned by the White House to go to Ukraine and add to the pressure for investigations. So he initially, in his first round of testimony, said he wasn't aware of the quid pro quo. But then after several other diplomats and officials testified, he went back into Congress and amended his testimony, saying the other testimony had refreshed his memory and that he did now remember that he had told Ukrainian official that military aid would depend on the announcement of an investigation.
Huh, you know what? That testimony I just heard really refreshed the old noodle here. You know, it made me remember one important detail, that I don't want to go to jail for perjury.
Why did he suddenly change his story?
Because he was beginning to look very exposed by a series of depositions from other officials, of people saying they remember quite clearly Sondland making a big deal about arranging a quid pro quo and insisting that the military aid and a White House visit would be dependent on the Ukrainians carrying out these very specific investigations.
Our memory is a funny thing. The name which has been a big part of this story, Julian, from the beginning, is Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, who essentially was working in the background to try and broker this deal in Ukraine for Trump. And he's constantly appeared on new shows to try and defend himself.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
Is he going to be called to testify?
He has so far refused to testify. It has become really a test of loyalty to Trump himself, whether you're going to testify. And he is the ultimate loyalist. Anyone in Trump's immediate circle will not be showing up. Trump has made an appearance in these impeachment hearings as a sign of disloyalty and has attacked and distanced himself from anyone who has done so. And although Sondland, who we were just talking about, was a major donor and who he had praised in the most fulsome fashion beforehand, after Sondland changed his recollection of what had happened, Trump said, "Well, I barely know this gentleman." So anyone who wants to stay close to Trump knows they must stay away from this whole impeachment process. So it has become a test of loyalty.
Julian, how do you think this particular phase of the impeachment process will play out?
I think that this public hearings will go up until just about Thanksgiving, which is later this month. So over the next couple of weeks, there'll be more public hearings from some of these key witnesses. And then there will be a break over Thanksgiving. And I imagine then the Democrats will start drawing up the articles of impeachment, basically the charge sheet. You can expect a vote on those articles probably early to mid-December. And so you're getting an impeachment trial in the run-up to Christmas, setting up a trial in the Senate in the new year.
And what might a conclusion to this look like, do you think?
I think the most likely conclusion is that at least one article of impeachment, one charge, will go to the Senate. And the Senate, which acts as a jury, will ultimately vote. And I think it is almost a foregone conclusion that there won't be 67 votes, two-thirds vote behind impeachment. So Trump will be acquitted. Obviously, there is a risk for the Democrats in all this, in that the perception of the Mueller report into collusion with Russia is that they failed to make the central charges stick. There is a risk that there will be a perception that they tried again with impeachment and still failed to kill the king, to get rid of the president. And so there is that. There a risk there that they will be seen as, to some extent, impotent in front of their own supporters. But I think that is a risk that the Democrats have decided they're ready to take. They hope to peel away a few Republicans who are in purple states, mixed states, where the general population is outraged at what they see, and so they're hoping for some Republican defectors. So it'll be, you know, in political terms, an unsatisfactory conclusion. Both sides will spin it their own way. But I think it is fair to say that Trump will enter 2020 and his re-election campaign as a weakened candidate, because we will have seen one government official, one U.S. diplomat after another going on television and saying he abused his office for political advantage in his dealings with Ukraine.
Julian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keep up with all the coverage of today's hearing from The Guardian's excellent U.S. team at theguardian.com, where you can also find tickets to a Guardian Live event on December the 10th in London, where a panel of our journalists will discuss the likelihood of Trump being impeached. Coming up, how are the Liberal Democrats getting on in this election campaign? Now, the election campaign is in full swing, and the Liberal Democrats, buoyed by their number of MPs rising to 20 in recent months, are hoping to gain even more with their promise to revoke Article 50. The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker is following them on the campaign trail.
The Lib Dems are quite enjoying the election. I mean, there's a reason they were one of the opposition parties who really, pushed for it, even though they're the most vehemently anti-Brexit party that there probably is. Brexit provides this big kind of opportunity for them to make a breakthrough.
There is no limit to my ambition for our party and our country. And today I am standing here as your candidate for Prime Minister.
Elections in Britain are increasingly presidential. Swinson is very, very much being kind of pushed forward. And this idea that she could become PM, you know, that's very much her line. It's a funny one because no one really believes that could be the case. But it's almost you have to, in politics, present this kind of slightly over-bullish confidence. And it's quite tricky for the Lib Dems because obviously the best they can realistically hope for is maybe to get, you know, 50 or 60 seats and then provide the balance of power, so maybe support a Labour government. But Swinson has made it very, very plain that she is not going to support Jeremy Corbyn. And almost that's a kind of doorstep line that they need to take, because if she didn't say that, then, you know, the Tories would have this kind of line saying, well, a vote for Jo Swinson is a vote for Corbyn. The leadership debates is an interesting one because the Lib Dems very, very fondly look back to the election in 2010 when we had the first kind of general election leadership debates, and Nick Clegg took part and did very, very well, and that was when the Lib Dems poll rating suddenly went up. And so the Liberal Democrats are really, really genuinely peeved that the BBC and ITV are having these debates with only Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. I think having Swinson in the debate would be very, very good for the Lib Dems, not least the kind of optics of it. You have these two quite conservative looking, you know, older men, and then you have this much younger woman who would be presenting a very, very different, you know, vehemently anti-Brexit line. But the fact that she's not going to be taking part also kind of gives them this election line of the establishment parties are trying to shut us out, you know, we're the kind of insurgents knocking at the door. So from that point of view, it helps them a little bit. For the Lib Dems to gain a reasonable number of seats, they basically have to stop being squeezed by a move of voters towards the Conservatives and Labour. Because in the 2017 election, all the smaller parties were completely squeezed because it was seen as this straight Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn fight. And in the end, the Conservatives and Labour got the highest joint share of their vote they got in a long, long time. And there's a danger that this election is shaping up in the same way. So what the Lib Dems have got to do is to partly just present themselves as being different, as being this very much anti-Brexit party. But the other thing as well, a lot of it's going to come down to tactical voting. And in this kind of, you know, Twitter savvy age, I think a lot more people are perhaps aware of how tactical voting works. So, for example, in some of the seats where the Lib Dems in the 2017 election came third, voters might not think of them as being a realistic option. But if they have, you know, emails or tweets or other social media telling them that the Lib Dems are actually now most likely to take the seat, then you might see some tactical voting from, you know, not just Labour to the Lib Dems, but Conservatives to Lib Dems. This election is such an unpredictable one, and, you know, the 1997 election is obviously known as the one where there are lots of shocks, you know, where lots of kind of well-known names fell. And this election is shaping up to be a kind of similar one, and the Lib Dems could be, you know, taking part in some of that.
That was Peter Walker. Thanks to him and Julian Borgia. Today's episode was produced by Eva Krisiak and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.